We're continuing in the book of Titus this morning. We have finally made it to Titus chapter 3, and now we're going to get into another one of Paul's more controversial concepts of what it is to be Christian. So I'm going to try to frame it in such a way that we understand it from Paul's perspective, and then we can talk about how it applies to us today, because there is a 2,000-year-old perspective, and then there is our more contemporary perspective in order to understand this. Paul is about to tell the folks there in Crete to be subject to the rulers and the governing authorities, the social governing authorities that are in place there in Crete. And we're going to compare what he said here to some of what he wrote in the Romans letter and talk a little bit this morning about a Christian's position and appropriate behavior within the society and the necessity for us to be cooperative with the governing authorities. Now, of course, because of the day and age in which we live and because of the tremendous number of social issues that we face now that weren't social issues 2,000 years ago, whenever you talk about this topic, modern contemporary Christians immediately are going to have questions and raise their hands and say, yeah, but what about? Because there are a lot of potential yeah, but what about topics as part of this larger concept. So let's start with the big concept. We're going to talk about it from a 2,000-year-old perspective and hold your yeah, what abouts until we deal with everything Paul has said about it, and then we'll talk about how it works in a more modern framework. Otherwise, I just know we'll get midway through it and someone will say, but abortion. And you're going to be right. And they're going to say, but what about the government's attempt to stop the preachment of the word? You're right. But until we really understand Paul's statements, let's hold those kind of questions till the end. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, now, in chapter 2 of the book of Titus, Paul has talked a lot about voluntary suppression or a voluntary willingness to give up on some of our own rights in order to benefit other people. It is a voluntary restriction of our own freedom for the good of the body of the church and for the good of others. When we talked about women being subject to their husbands, or younger women being subject to older women, young men being subject to older men, or even Paul's writing in the book of Hebrews, where he talks about everybody within the church being subject to the leaders that God has put in place so that the church is not of confusion, so that the church itself has a structure and leadership. All of those concepts are hard on our flesh because whenever we hear be subject to somebody else, our ego instantly says no. Because I'm a self-made man and I'm going to do what I want to do and I won't be subject to anybody. And so that's why it's so important to grasp that concept, the way Paul talked about servants, bond slaves, being obedient to their masters. Their natural tendency was going to be to not be obedient, to be pilfering, to try to run away, to escape, to undermine their master. And so Paul says that within Christianity, once you have been indwelt by the Holy Spirit, once you have grasped some concept of what it is that Christ has done for you, that changes every part of your life, and it changes your attitude, and it makes you willing then to forego some of that egocentricity that formerly drove you and make you voluntarily or willingly able to subject yourself in situations where you really never would have before. And so women whose tendency is to want to go their own way, do their own thing, are then willing to subject themselves to their husband because that makes for better marriage. And men are willing then to subject themselves to leadership within the church because that's what's good for the body and good for the whole of the church. And young men are willing then to subject themselves to the wisdom of older men because that's what's good for the body and good for them individually. The end result of all of this being a peace and a unity and a cooperation within the Christian church body that can't exist any other way except through this concept that Paul has been hammering away at in chapter 2, that everybody needs to be willing to curb their own ego, curb their own desires, and I keep using this term voluntarily because that's the word in the Greek, to voluntarily limit your own freedom for the good of the cooperative whole and for the good of every individual within the cooperative whole. Does that make sense? You remember all that? That was all review of things that we learned in chapter 2, hopefully. And that's the same attitude and aspect from which he's going to approach the question of civil authority. Because it is not always true that the civil authority is going to be right or just or godly. We certainly have seen ungodly leadership. But Paul is going to argue from a position of absolute sovereignty, and since we are in this church body absolute sovereigntists, because we do believe that God knows what he's doing and he's in absolute control of his universe, then whatever the powers are at any given moment, those are the powers that God has set in place on purpose in order to bring about his designed and predetermined end. My brother and I were up at Vanderbilt University on Friday and helping him get his new installation in. So I was up there running wires and doing computers for him and stuff. And of course, Vanderbilt is a reasonably, shall we say, liberal campus? Yeah, let's say that. Okay, it's a pretty liberal campus. And at one point, we were in his car in the parking lot, and we saw a brand new, I'd never seen these before, a brand new Obama 2012 bumper sticker. See, now a lot of folks just winced when I said that. And folks kind of went, ooh. And yeah, my brother and I kind of had the same immediate visceral reaction, which was, really? In this situation we're in right now, with the debt being the way it is, and the country being out of work, and, you know, with things being the way they are, really? You're going to vote for more of that? Is that really the direction you're going to take? But then we were reminded in the midst of our really, we were reminded, well, you know, stranger and worse things have happened. And my brother said, what if Obama was reelected? Well, the answer to what if is God's sovereign. God's still in control and he knows what he's doing. And oh yeah, if the Bible is true and if our understanding of the Bible is true, then things are going to get worse before they get better. And we Christians love to say, oh, we're looking forward to the coming of the Lord. We talked about that just last week. That is our blessed hope. We're looking for the return of Christ. We're looking for that blessed moment of the instantaneous change of our bodies or the gathering together of the church to meet the Lord in the air. And so will we ever be with the Lord. Boy, that's great language. But oh yeah, in order to get there, everything has to get really bad. We got to be right on the crux of potential world annihilation before the good stuff happens. And so each passing generation of Christians on the planet have hoped that they were the generation that would be alive on the planet when Christ came back, but nobody wants to be part of the trouble. So there's sort of a disconnect there where we want to be here when Christ comes back, but oh yeah, if we are, boy, it could go really tough on us as Christians. And so maybe part of that whole tough on us as Christians thing is part of what we're seeing in the world right now. It's true that the world in many ways is growing increasingly anti-Christian, increasingly anti-biblical, and that is as it's meant to be. In fact, it's going to shake out, for lack of a better term, the men from the boys. Why isn't there a similar term like that for females? Don't go there? Just let it go? Okay. The process. Okay, come back, people. Come back. the process of separating the genuine Christians from the nominal marginal Christians is going to be the process of difficulty and hardship. Jesus was very clear about that when he talked about the different kinds of soil that the seed would fall on. And he took the time to explain that particular parable and said that the seed was the word, and it goes out and falls on different kinds of ground. And one kind of ground that it fell on, it took root and it grew up quickly, but then the cares of this world and the trials of this life come and pull it out. And so there are going to be folk aplenty who say, I'm Christian because that's kind of a socially acceptable thing to do, especially here in the South, living in a buckle of the Bible Belt. When I first moved here and met my neighbor across the street, his questions were, hi, what's your name, and what do you do for a living, and where do you go to church? I mean, it's just instantaneous assumption that you're going to be a Christian person and that you go to church. But it's going to be very different when going to church can actually get you persecuted. When naming the name of Christ will actually do damage to your career, will actually put your standing socially in jeopardy. When that kind of thing happens, we're going to find out who's actually committed to Christ, even to the point where they're willing to give up their own life and their own livelihood and their own well-being that the cause of Christ may increase. We're going to find that out when the trouble starts coming. When it's easy, when the church is fat and wealthy and everything's going great, and when the church is able to provide, you know, classes and programs and entertainment, then it's easy to go to church because it's just something that you're doing. But when it becomes hard to say you're a Christian, when it reaches the point like it did in Rome, where the Christians were meeting in the catacombs of the dead underneath the city just so that they could gather together without being killed or persecuted, that's when you find out who's really into Christianity. That's when you find out who is blood-bought and spirit-filled, and when they're just going along with it because it's something to do socially. So Paul, 2,000 years ago, was living in an environment where to be a Christian could indeed be a death sentence. And so it was very common for people to try to hide their Christianity or try to not let people know that that was their particular bent. And that was something that Paul was always having to deal with and telling people to be bold. He even prayed and asked others to pray for him, that he would have the boldness to preach Christ, because after all, every time he did, trouble ensued. Riots broke out. He got beaten with 39 lashes 5 different times just to get him to shut up, or stoned and left for dead outside of Lystra. He's writing this letter from prison simply because he was bold enough to preach Christ in a time and in a place and in a society where preaching Christ was something that was being systematically suppressed, both by the Jews because of their vested interest in keeping Christianity at bay, because if Christianity was true, if Christ did really get up, then they, the leaders in Jerusalem, were indeed whitewashed sepulchers and were indeed unforgiven in this age and the age to come. They had a vested interest in making sure that Christianity stopped. And Rome went through different periods and different waves of persecuting Christianity because Christianity was a big red flag that said Caesar is not God. There is a God and Caesar's not it. Christ is God, Yahweh is God, the God of Israel is real, and Caesar is just a man. And since Caesar worship was part of the social religion that was the fabric of the whole society and united them, if you were to undermine Caesar worship, you're undermining the basic fabric of the whole society. So Christianity comes along and says, Caesar's not God, Christ is God. And of course, Rome then would see that as a threat to their whole society and civility. And so they have a vested interest in suppressing Christianity. Now, if Christians then were likely to do anything, they were likely to then think of the leadership and the government as being their enemy, as being against them. And so it would be natural, it would be human for Christians to say, we need to do whatever we can to rebel against that suppressive government. We need to make sure that we're taking up arms and fighting against that government. That's the human reaction. We're seeing it right now in our nation. We're seeing it with these Occupy movements across the country. People who are saying, I believe the government is suppressing me in some way, or Wall Street is, or the banks aren't treating me right. We need to take to the streets. That's the natural human reaction. So Paul writes and says, remind them. Now this is specific, by the way. I have to point out that them is the people in Crete. And remember Paul's own assessment of what the Cretans are like. Back in chapter 1, verse 12, he said, one of themselves, speaking of those in Crete, one of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. And then Paul adds, and this testimony is true. And stay there with them, Titus. There's your assignment. Good luck with that. So for this cause, reprove them severely that they may be sound in the faith. Because after all, you're dealing with people who are liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. So reprove them severely. Now, there are several commentaries that say that there is some evidence that the residents of Crete at this particular time were the type who were likely to riot, who were likely to rebel. And at the slightest whiff of any kind of suppression of their personal individual freedom, they would break out in fights. They'd break out in riots. They were fierce in their defense of their individual freedom. So now Paul writes to them and says, now Titus, remind them to be subject to rulers. Now that's completely antithetical to the way they were naturally thinking. After all, they were fierce in their defense of their own individual freedom, and now they're Christians, and now the likelihood of some kind of suppression because they're Christians would naturally stir up their human fleshly inclination and their ego, and they would want to go riot in the streets. That's what they would want to do. And instead, Paul says, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, and to be ready for every good deed. So by contrast, this idea of going out and rioting and causing trouble, he considers that to be the antithesis of genuine Christianity. So let me see if I can help us get the Pauline mindset where Christianity is concerned. You've got this friction. You've got the dilemma of the government that wants to suppress Christianity. You've got the Jewish leadership that wants to suppress Christianity. So now how are you going to respond to that? Are you going to respond by taking up swords and grabbing your shields and spears and taking to the streets? Or, Paul's response to it is, be so good that they can't say anything against you. Be such a good citizen that you're just simply not doing anything wrong that they can oppose you over. He goes so far as to say every man should just work with his own hands, quietly, doing his own life, working so that he has something that he can give to others. Paul's attitude is, if Christians would just live so righteously and so civilly within the society that the rulers then would have nothing with which to convict Christians, and they could continue to live their quiet life, working with their own hands, providing for their own families, living their life. Paul saw that as more valuable than getting out in the streets, causing riots and problems, and ultimately being imprisoned or suppressed. Instead, if Christ is in fact inhabiting the church ought to be salt and light in the society. The church ought to be someplace that people gravitate toward. The church ought to be a place that a society is happy to have in their midst because it brings about goodness. Now, a lot of the contemporary laws that we find, even here in America, are based on that presumption that Christianity and the church is good for the society. For instance, the tax code in the United States at this moment allows churches to be tax exempt. You can file for what's called a 501c3, which allows you to be a tax exempt corporation or religious organization, and that allows you to collect money and not have to pay taxes on it, or any land or property that you use for that religious purpose, nonprofit purpose, is not taxable. The reason that that original code was written was because the church in the society was taking some of the burden off of the government by doing things like feeding the poor and clothing the poor and helping with shelter. And so it was good to have church in the society, and it took a burden off the government, and so the government allowed that the church not be taxed because the church was doing good things for the society. And of course, as soon as you tax something, you have the power to control it, and so the church was not taxed, so that that separation of church and state thing, in its proper understanding, kept the state from encroaching on the church. These days, when people say separation of church and state, what they mean is keep the church from encroaching on the state. The phrase, to begin with, isn't in the Constitution anywhere. It was in a letter that Jefferson wrote. And what he meant by it, clearly, was to keep the state out of the church's affairs. And so it was another reason that the church wasn't taxed. But it's good to have a church within a society, and that is the Christian mindset. That should be the Christian paradigm, is that we as Christians within the society live our lives in such a way that the society is happy to have us there. You know, I've said a couple times last few weeks that any employer should look forward to hiring Christians. That should be a good thing. They should want Christians. They should say, yes, send me Christians, because they're going to be honest and they're going to show up on time. They're not going to steal from me. They're going to do their job. If they say they're going to do it, they're going to keep their word. That ought to be the way the world views Christians. Unfortunately, these days, people view Christians through the lens of what they see on TBN and all of the chicanery and all the foolishness and the silliness that is called Christianity. But genuine, real, serious Christianity ought to be salt and light, preservative in a society. And that's Paul's attitude toward it. Turn to Romans, if you would. Keep your finger or a bookmark or something there in Titus. Turn to Romans 13. And we'll get a broader view of Paul's thinking on this topic. And we're going to start in verse 1 of Romans 13. And we'll do that just as soon as Christian finds it. We're all waiting on you, Christian. No pressure. Come on, man. We're waiting. Find it. I'm just picking on you, Christian. All right. Romans chapter 13. Verse 1 begins, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. There you go. Paul's attitude is sovereigntist. Paul's perspective is God's in charge. And so he says, whatever authority is in place at any given moment, that's because God put that authority in place at that moment. Think about Isaiah talking about predicting the rise of Cyrus. And of course, he predicts Cyrus 150 years in advance and calls him by name. And God, speaking through Isaiah, says, I'm going to raise you up, and I'm going to make you rich and powerful, and I'm going to subdue nations before you, though you don't know me. It's very interesting language. It's not that Cyrus was any kind of saved man that was trying to do the will of God. It's that Cyrus was a heathen king that God raised up on purpose in order to keep Israel in line. In other words, Cyrus and the Medo-Persian kingdom conquered the Babylonian kingdom on purpose so that they would be in place to keep the Israelites, particularly the southern tribes, in bondage in Babylon. And then God raises up Cyrus on purpose in order for Cyrus to make a decree to let the Israelites go back to rebuild their temple, which he does. It's a fact of history that absolutely boggles historians. Why would a Medo-Persian leader allow his servants, his captured slaves, to go back and rebuild their temple? Why? Well, because... take what you need. Yeah, well, go do it. Of course, you know, the whole handwriting on the wall thing was helpful. Yeah. He had plenty of good impetus. But the point is, God set Cyrus in place on purpose. When Nebuchadnezzar walked around saying, "My great hand has built all this great Babylon," God made him crazy for a while to show who was in charge, but it was still God who raised him up and put him in place. God put Pontius Pilate in charge in Judea at that exact moment in that exact place in order that Christ would die on that exact day under those exact circumstances. It was Domitian in the late 80s to early 90s AD who sent John to the Isle of Patmos. He wasn't sending him there to write the book of Revelation. He sent him there because he was a prisoner of Rome and he just wanted to get rid of him, just get him out of here. And so he gets there, Jesus meets him at Patmos and gives him the book we know as the book of Revelation. Was it God's sovereign providence that put him on Patmos? Sure. How did God get him on Patmos? By raising up Domitian. God is sovereign, is my point. So God did not stop being sovereign once the Bible was written. When it got to like 100 AD, God didn't go, "All right, I got everything in place, I'm going to rest now." He's still completely in charge, and he's still raising up kingdoms and still taking down kingdoms and still moving people groups around the planet in order to set everything up geopolitically exactly the way he said it's going to be in the book of Revelation so that he can bring about the events that will lead to the return of his son. And when we look at the world right now, it is aligning itself geopolitically exactly the way Daniel said it was going to be, exactly the way it would have to be for the book of Revelation to be true.
That's right.
And no generation of people on planet Earth have seen the sort of events and countries and geopolitical deals and relationships and contracts. We've never, ever on planet Earth had the kind of situation we see in the world today where we really could see everything the Bible describes fulfilled. We could see it. 50 years ago, everybody having a mark in their right hand, their forehead, can't buy, sell, or trade without it. Tough to figure. How's that going to work? We could all imagine it now. We all know how that would work. Everybody knows. It's easy. Now that we have electronic money and electronic funding, easy. I can figure that out. Sure. Daniel said that in the final days, men would run to and fro and knowledge would increase. Well, that's a cryptic thing to say until the internet showed up. And all of a sudden, everybody has access to everything. If you're looking from God's perspective down on the planet for the last 6,000 years of human existence, people grew up and lived in the same place. From God's perspective, looking at the planet, once he planted people someplace, they stayed there. But ever since the invention of the automobile and the airplane and all the various forms of transportation we have, suddenly, from God's perspective, men run to and fro all over the world, all over the country. People born somewhere and live somewhere else and travel somewhere else at the exact same time that knowledge is increasing, at the exact same time that we can imagine having to buy, sell, or trade through an electronic device in our right hand or our forehead. My point is this. The way that God is setting everything up, exactly the way he described in Daniel and Revelation and Ezekiel, the way that he is creating the world environment that perfectly matches what he predicted, is through the governments and the leaderships that he has put in place for this particular place and time. The reason that the agreements are happening that we're seeing, the reason that there is the Palestinian problem in the Middle East, and the reason that there is Ahmadinejad over there claiming that he's going to push Israel into the sea. The fact that those things are all coalescing and converging at the exact same time is because God has placed those particular leaders in those particular countries at this very moment, and at the same time put a very strong leader in Israel who's ready to defend Israel and who has said this week that he's pretty much ready to let bombs start flying, and they're testing their missiles. They're rattling their sabers over there in the Middle East. And you know, one of the most remarkable realities of human history and biblical prophecy is that no matter how hard the world tries to get away from the Middle East, it's always the Middle East that looks like it's going to be the fulcrum of the next world war.
Yeah, witness is going to be seen around the world.
Sure.
It's going
to be seen around the world. Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Gladys was saying in the book of Revelation, the two final witnesses, when they're killed, are left in the streets for 3 days, and it says the whole world sees them. Everybody in the world can see them. Okay, 50 years ago, could you have imagined that? People would have said, well, maybe TV, but suddenly there's satellites and internet and everything else. Everybody can see it now. So the point Gladys is making is we just happen to be living in a day, in an age, and in a situation unlike any previous generation on planet Earth where everything that the Bible has described could come true very quickly now. It could all happen really, really fast right now. How is God accomplishing that? Well, through the leaders that he's put in place, the same way he has when he raised up Cyrus or raised up Nebuchadnezzar or raised up Caesar Nero, or Domitian. God has a long history of raising up particular leaders to accomplish his particular foreordained, predestined plan. And he's doing it even today. Now, if that's true, then we want to be on God's side in that equation. We don't want to be arguing against or rebelling against how God is accomplishing what is ultimately going to be for our good. Right? Does this make sense? Okay. So let every person, says chapter 13, verse 1, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Verse 2, therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Now that word right there, by the way, is not katakrima. It's not one of the words that means God judges. What this word means is probably a civil kind of punishment, that if you're in rebellion, you're going to be thrown in jail. That's the kind of word that he's using here, because I know in the King James and some other translations it says those who are opposed will be, what are some of your other words? Judged. I think there's one that says damned or will incur judgment. Okay. It's a condemnation that they bring upon themselves because they're in opposition for this reason. Verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. So again, Paul is consistently calling Christians to good behavior, but they're a cause of fear for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Then do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For the civil authority is the minister of God. That's diakonos. It's the same word from which we get deacon or minister. It basically means that he's there in place in order to accomplish God's will, which is lack of confusion within a society. Remember that we're talking about a God here who is big on rules. After all, he gave Israel the law, 613 rules, and then said, now live by these rules and we're going to get along fine. And some of those rules are just civil rules. They're just how to live together as a society. It's stuff like don't move a marker for a boundary. If you see your neighbor's oxen stuck in the mud, pull them out. Build an eave on the side of your roof, so if somebody's on your roof and they fall, they don't fall to their death. Some of these are just good, logical, civil rules, but God is very logical, and God is not of confusion. God is one who likes organization. And so the rulers are put in place, and when they are, emphasizing the good and punishing the bad, Paul says they are operating then as diakonos, as ministers of God, in that they are emphasizing goodness within the society and punishing evil within the society. But if you do what is evil, then be afraid, for it does not, the governing authority does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. So that's the definition of how he is a minister for God. He is bringing the sword, bringing vengeance against those that do evil within the society, and to that degree, they're doing what God would have them do. And so they are a minister of God. Verse 5 says, wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection. And this is very, very interesting, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. The wrath he's talking about is the wrath of the civil authority. I don't want to go to jail. You know, there are a lot of people who say the death penalty is not a deterrent. I say, well, yeah, it is. It's going to deter that guy. He won't be doing that anymore. And I actually think that proper punishment, appropriate punishment of a crime, is a deterrent against doing that crime. I'll give you an example. We've been doing all this heavy stuff here, so I'll give you a more lighthearted example. When I first moved here to Middle Tennessee, I lived with my folks out in Shelbyville. And I don't know how familiar any of you are with Shelbyville, but right there in the square in Shelbyville, which, by the way, just the way I'm pronouncing Shelbyville proves that I'm not from Shelbyville. Yeah, it's Shevel. Shevel. Yeah. I figured out how to speak Southern after I moved here. I found out that you take multisyllabic words like Shelbyville and you shorten them as much as you can. Say Shevel. And then you take single-syllable words like my name and you make it as long as you can. Jim. That's how you speak Southern, if you just follow those rules. Anyway, right there in the square in Shelbyville, there is this old rock jailhouse. And the walls are made of rock, and there's no heating, there's no cooling. There's just some slats with bars between some of the rocks that let air blow through. And the crime rate in Shelbyville was actually quite low because people didn't want to go there because it was a really uncomfortable place to be. Well, the state came in and said that that was cruel and inhuman and that they had to build a new jailhouse, which they did, with heat and air conditioning and TVs and, you know, workout room and all that, you know, all the stuff that a jail, a prison is supposed to have.
Cafeteria,
yeah, just all the stuff. And the crime rate went up exponentially. Jail-type offenses just started rising and rising because people weren't afraid to go there. The point of that is, Paul is saying, there are two reasons to be good and avoid evil. One is because you don't want to go to that rock jail because you're afraid of wrath. But the other half of the equation is even more interesting. The other half is for conscience sake. So that your Christian conscience is clear before God. So that you know that you are living in such a way that you are appropriately representing Christ and Christianity and that your conscience is clear by the way that you behave. And so he says it's necessary to be in subjection not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God. Some of the older translations still say ministers there. The King James still says ministers there. Doesn't make a differentiation between the two. This is the word liturgos, from which we get liturgy, liturgical. It's not diakonos. And so the NASB makes a difference in the translation, says that they are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. So render to all what is due to them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. In other words, participate in the society. Do you remember when Jesus was tested by the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders? And they asked him, should we pay taxes? Should we pay tax to Rome? And of course, what they were trying to do was get him to give an answer that would cause a problem. If he was to say yes, then he's admitting that Israel is completely subject to Rome, and then the people that were following him were less likely to follow him because they hated Rome and they hated the, you know, everywhere they turned there were Roman legions and soldiers stationed everywhere, and they just had a real deep disdain for Rome. So if Jesus, as a religious leader, stands up and says, yes, do honor to Rome, then people are going to disagree with that, and the leaders were hoping that they would leave over that. If he said no, then he's causing insurrection against Rome, and the Roman leaders are going to come get him. So there's no good answer to this question. And so they say, is it right? Should we pay taxes to Rome? He wisely says, because you can't trick him, he says, give me a coin. And he looks at the coin and he says, whose superscription is on the coin? In other words, whose image is it? And they say, well, that's Caesar on the coin. And so he says, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's. In other words, that money belongs to Caesar to start with. It's got his face right on it. And so that belongs to Caesar, and so give it to Caesar. It's his. But then he says, and give to God what is God's. And as soon as he says that, he has just said, Caesar's not God. There is a God, but it's not Caesar. So he has said, you know, we're under this Roman persecution. Caesar worship isn't appropriate. All those people who want to throw off Rome agree with him. He's still with, good, you said Caesar's not God. We're with you, great. But at the same time, he wasn't looking for civil unrest. He said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Now, in the whole history of Christendom and in everything that's written in the New Testament, what you don't find is any New Testament writer saying, come on, Christians, let's cause insurrection. You just don't find it. You don't find a call anywhere in the New Testament to civil disobedience. It's not in there. Instead, what you find is stuff like, pray for those who persecute you. Love your enemies. Don't revile those that have reviled you. Instead, you're supposed to pray for them. It's counterintuitive, but it's Christianity 101. It's what we're supposed to be like. Again, salt and light in the world, not being human, not being egocentric, not upsetting the society, rather being a preservative in the society. And we're supposed to be a bright, shining example of godliness in the world. Or let me put it to you this way. I don't know how many of you have been watching any of the things that are going on in these Occupy groups. There's been a lot of problems now growing in these Occupy movements. And when the Occupy movement began, there were a lot of folks like you and I who were just kind of sympathetic to the cause, some more so than others. But we understood at least the cause. Okay, Wall Street got all these bailouts. They didn't pass the money along. They're holding the money, and the fat cats are getting big payouts. That's not fair. Okay, I get the argument. Okay, I get it. But I don't know if you saw any of the video this week from Oakland where the occupiers are marching through the streets, busting out shop windows, tearing down public furniture and stuff, ruining, just going through city streets, just rioting, causing trouble. Now, of course, as soon as that video gets out, people who were initially empathetic are no longer empathetic. Instead, you got to be pretty over there on the far extreme side to say, yeah, go do that, yeah, because you don't want them on your block ruining your stuff. And it's not right what they were doing. It's just flat not right. They should not be destroying private property that belongs to other people who did nothing but go to work that day. And now their business is being destroyed by people who are ostensibly arguing about the unfairness of how money is spent in our society. It's not right and it's unfair, but what it's done is it's undermined any initial legitimacy the movement might have had, and instead is causing this groundswell of people against the movement now because the movement is into rioting and carousing and causing trouble and problems. Well, that being the case, Christianity is not benefited if that's the way we act. So Paul goes on to say, verse 8, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. So he said, you know, pay your tax, pay your custom, fear to whom fear, honor to who honor, go ahead and pay it. Don't owe anybody anything. And the only thing you owe anybody is to love your neighbor. Then he talks for a few minutes about love doing no wrong and how love is a fulfillment of the law. And I don't want to get into that at the moment. But jump down to verse 13. Let us behave properly as in the day. This is language Paul uses a lot to say that people in the day are more likely to behave properly than people in the night, because in the night, people in the dark are more likely to try to get away with stuff. So he says, let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and in jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. And some of your translations there where it says not carousing and drunkenness, it says not rioting, not out in the streets. So again, my point being, Christianity has never been about rioting in the streets. Christianity, the Pauline version of Christianity, is that we be such good citizens that the ruling authorities have nothing bad to say about us, no charge they can level against us, and that we be the kind of people that are attractive to the society where people would actually see that there's nothing to be afraid of. I'll give you another example. How comfortable would any of you be with having a mosque next door? See, we're not comfortable with that idea, are we? The funny thing is, none of you want to say it out loud because you're afraid. We're concerned. We're fearful about Islam in the world and the violence that often accompanies it. But we're also a little bit afraid to say that, because if you say anything against Islam, you're more likely to make yourself a target. And so we all kind of live with that reality, that fear. Okay, that is the inverse of how people ought to view Christianity. People should look at Christianity as people who are going to be safe and kind and loving and generous, and who are going to raise up the goodness of God and demonstrate it in the way that we live and in the way that we take care of people and accept people and bring people to Christ and godliness. Do you understand that? So back to Titus now. With all that in mind, chapter 3 of Titus, verse 1, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be uncontentious, to be gentle, showing every consideration for all men. Now, by the way, this is another example of the word pos. Remember, we talked before about groups and all kinds, all types. That's what he's saying here. All kinds of men, even those that are rulers, even civil authorities, even those that you would innately think, well, I could never be kind to them. He says, no, you be kind to all kinds of people. And then look at what he says, just so that there's no confusion about what he's getting at. In verse 3, he says, for we also once were foolish ourselves. Something changed. Something's different. We used to also be foolish, but we're not anymore. Why? Because we're Christians. Because we have the Holy Spirit of God. We were also once foolish. We were disobedient. That's in contrast to him saying, be obedient, back in verse 1. We were deceived. We were enslaved to various lusts and pleasures. We were spending our life in malice and envy. We were hateful, hating one another, but when the kindness of God our Savior and His love for mankind appeared, He saved us. Not on the basis of deeds which we have done in righteousness, but according to His own mercy, by the washing of regeneration and the renewing of the Holy Spirit, whom He poured out upon us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior. We're going to get into that next week. That's right, we're going to pick up and get into the theology of that. But notice the contrast that Paul creates here. Be obedient to rulers and to authorities. Be subject to them. Don't malign anybody. Don't be contentious. Be gentle. Show consideration for all kinds of men, because we used to be, before our conversion, we used to be foolish and disobedient and deceived and enslaved to various lusts and pleasures. We used to spend our life in malice and envy. We were hateful, hating one another, but now we're different. When I look at the video that I was mentioning this week of what's going on in Oakland and the destruction and the marching in the streets, all you see in those videos is hate. People with masks and their faces covered, which, by the way, is the very definition of the word hypocrite in the Bible. With their faces covered, going through the streets, just destroying stuff. And they're just mad, and they don't even really know what they're mad at. Because smashing the windows in the front of some guy's store, some guy's business, does absolutely nothing to change the inequity of how the money's being used on Wall Street. It does nothing. All it does is express that you're hateful, you're malicious, you're mean, you're dark-hearted. That's all it shows. That's all it demonstrates. And Paul says, that's what we were all like by nature. We would be out there too, were it not for the fact that God got a hold of us, that he changed us, that he conformed us, and now our goal in life is to help people, to be good to people, to not malign people, to do whatever we can to lift up Christ and to benefit one another. That is not our normal fleshly way of being. It's how we are because of what God did through us and in us. You get all that? Are there any questions about Paul's attitude on this topic, where this is concerned? Because now is the time when you get to say, but what about abortion? Now, the Bible doesn't talk about it outside of thou shalt not kill. But shouldn't we, as Christian people, shouldn't we do something about the mass genocide that's going on in America? Isn't that a cause? I mean, certainly in most Christian circles, people say this is a cause that Christians ought to be involved in. And I say yes, because that's a good cause. You're defending the innocent. You're defending the right to life of the unborn. Should you shoot abortionists? No. And unfortunately, the handful of people who ever have end up saying, I'm Christian and I'm doing this for God, and I watch it on the TV and just grab my head and go, no, don't say that. When they put the microphone in front of you and put the camera in front of you and say, why did you do this? Say, I'm a lone nut. Say that. I'm a crazy person and I hate, you know, say that. Don't say I'm a Christian and that's why I'm doing this. Should we get out there and vote our conscience as Christians? Yes, absolutely. For many, many years, I was rather apolitical, mostly because I didn't know and I didn't care. The more Christian I became, the more convinced I became that I should vote. A whole lot of people fought and died and gave their blood for my right to vote. And so now I vote, and I have for the last 10, 15 years. And I vote my conscience, but I vote the same way I pray. I put in front of God what my will is. I want these guys to be in office. And then I leave the voting booth and say, thy will be done. And God is sovereign, and God is going to do what God's going to do. And he is designing everything in our world in such a way that his son is going to crack the sky and come back and get his church and judge the world. And let me throw this last caveat in here, because it's part of the Pauline mindset. Judge not, lest ye also be judged, is the same reason that Paul said, remember, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. And it's knowing that the evil world is not getting away with it that will help you to be kind to them and to be helpful in an increasingly dark world. Because you know, like Jesus said, that when you give a glass of water to your enemy, you're just pouring hot coals on his head. To him, it looks like a glass of cold water. But you know that God's sovereign. You know that God is going to avenge himself of all his enemies. And since he's really a whole lot better at that than you are, let him do it. You just do the next right thing. And part of the next right thing, according to Paul, is being obedient to civil authorities. Are there any other but whatabouts? Do we kind of get it? Yes, there are certainly places in our society where we are called to participate and to be salt and light in our society. So by all means, get in there. Would I like to see a decidedly Christian president? I'd like to see Christians in every walk of life. But am I going to be okay even if the guy in the White House isn't Christian? Yeah, because ultimately my well-being is up to God. And he's able to provide for me, and he's able to keep me safe, and he's able to take me through this life. And for 2,000 years, Christianity has always been a thorn in the side of the evil of this world. So I'll just continue being that thorn in their side, and I'll continue saying God is real and Christ is coming back, and I will continue proclaiming the gospel of God's free and sovereign grace until the day they shut me down and say, I can't do that anymore. And on that day, I will send you all private notes where we will write in the sand to say where the next meeting will be. But I will not quit as long as I've got breath in my body, and I will leave God to be sovereign, and he will control this world, and he will take care of us.
And that goes on in other parts of the world.
It sure does. We're just so fortunate.
Like the Chinese churches, they actually have people on lookout, I mean, while they're secretly meeting. Just all in the Sudan. I mean,
Yeah.
We just can't really understand it.
We just don't know what it is to be killed for being Christian. We're just really spoiled. If you're seeing your loved ones and your congregation being killed every day, and like you said, you've got lookouts just so that the church can meet, then yes, the natural inclination is going to be rise up against this.
There's that one, that Chinese one I'm thinking of specifically, in a video on somebody around church. And you see these pastors, they are crying out for the leaders of China. I mean, they're praying there. It's just so opposite of what we think.
I'm so glad you just said that, because part of the big Pauline mindset is, he does say, that we're to pray for the leaders and the civil authorities so that we can live a quiet life. It's ultimately for our good that we're praying to God that they will control the civil authorities in such a way that we will continue to be able to preach the gospel and live our lives and be okay. Because again, it goes back to that sovereignty concept that whoever is in authority under the hand of God. And God has the ability to constrain them. God has the ability to control them and limit their power. And so we are to pray to God to control the powers that be for our benefit. And that's what Jeff was getting at. It's amazing to see those Chinese Christian pastors crying out to God about their leaders, praying that God would convert them, change them so that Christ is exalted and so that we are safe. Yes, ma'am.
To take it one step further, our inability to understand sovereignty is one thing, but also when Paul wrote this, there was no institutional government like the one that exists here, where people themselves are required to be government participants. Mm-hmm. So here, if you abdicate your role of involvement, you're abdicating your role as your own government, which is kind of a crazy twist on that. Yeah. And even behooves us to be praying for our fellow man, because every person around us is a part of the government here.
Yeah, it was not exactly a democratic republic in Rome back when he was writing these things. Yeah. Yes, sir?
I'm just curious about this. Subject to authority, and yet they met secretly in hiding. Is it just a natural tension that's going to exist between a person's conscience?
Remember that he kind of defines what part of that subjection is. Pay your taxes, honor whoever honor is due, fear to whom fear. That's not, you know, slavish fear. It's the word for respect, appropriate respect. Now, by the way, I can find an example in the New Testament of civil disobedience. Peter was told, don't preach anymore. And they put him in jail. They said, now quit doing that. And then there's an angel and an earthquake and he's out. And he's preaching again. Because the call to do what God called him to do was a higher law. I was looking for a different verb, but I'll go with was a higher law. was more incumbent on Peter than what the civil authorities told him to do. So for that reason, I can say that we have plenty of biblical impetus for not allowing the government to ever shut us up or shut us down. If they say, stop preaching, I'm going to find a street corner and preach. And if they put me in jail, I'm going to preach to whoever's around me. And if they put me in solitary, I'm going to preach to the guard. I mean, I'm going to preach either way because that's what I'm called to do. And the call of God on my life supersedes anything that the society may tell me where God is concerned. So there are examples in the Bible of places where it is appropriate for the Christian to follow God rather than man. And that was Peter's argument. He said, should I obey man or God? If I should obey man, then I'm not the servant of God. So ultimately, we know whose servant we are, but because we're God's servant, we live a certain way. And we live that way, voluntarily giving up some of our own freedoms, suppressing our own ego, so that Christ is glorified. So it's all still consistent.
God is in charge of who preaches where.
Yeah, absolutely. God is in charge of who preaches where. He made Paul the great evangelist and then stuck him in prison. God's in charge of who preaches where. He tried to go east and the Holy Spirit constrained him and said, no, you're going to... I'm sorry, what?
And looking at all of that continent now, you see Western and then totally opposite.
Absolutely. God's in charge of that.
No, you're not going that.
You're going this way. Yep. Heard the Macedonian call. Got to go to Macedonia. Wanted to go east. God said no. To this day, the world is broken up east and west, and the western half of the world is Christian and the eastern isn't. God's in charge. Anything else? All right, good. Say goodbye to all the internet folks.
Bye. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.